The Beast from the East, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Record cold temperatures and snow across Europe right now, but closer to the North Pole, the warmest February on record.
We've actually got open water at the top of Greenland right now, which is incredibly unusual. This is a very, very surprising thing to see.
Also, a major seller of outdoor gear in Canada is pressured to drop brands linked to an American gun company.
We're talking about changing who we buy from, because that is a powerful vote.
Plus, the unexpectedly glitzy side of life under Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The more politically oppressive Russia becomes, sort of the more pleasant Moscow becomes as kind of an urbanist paradise, as a place just to live and, you know, have dinner.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being here. It is wacky out there, a line you could apply to a lot of things lately, on any given day. Today, though, we are referring to a very specific sense of wackiness. I'm thinking of climate scientists and their use of WACC, W-A-C-C, Warm Arctic Cold Continent. They would say this is a wacky time because this should be when Europe's winter is finally drawing to a close. But instead, we're seeing snowfall, some of it heavy, from Ireland to Italy. This cold air that's been displaced from Russia and Eastern Europe already has a media-friendly name, the Beast from the East. My BBC partner, Leo Hornack, helps me kick things off today from London. Leo, what is the Beast from the East like there in the British capital?
I mean, it's a great name, isn't it, Marco? I mean, I was standing on the street corner just about an hour ago, just outside the BBC offices, and I looked up and I could see BBC producers having a snowball fight on the roof.
Wow.
And it's weird. It makes you feel like you've gone in a strange kind of time loop. It feels like it's about to be Christmas all over again, except there's no like Santa tat in all the windows. There's kind of daffodils in the park, but they're covered in snow. And on a quite sort of deep level, it makes you feel like your body clock's gone wrong. Your kind of seasonal clock's gone wrong. Because it feels like we did this. We did this 3 months ago. We're supposed to be getting warm now.
Safe to say you've never seen a snowball fight at the BBC at the end of February.
Exactly.
For you personally, is it a jolt weather-wise? Did it catch you off guard?
Yeah, I mean, I think it did the whole continent, really. I was about to say the whole nation, but as you say, this is Ireland to Italy. When you look on British social media, my Facebook feed, everything is about the weather right now. I had a chat with some people in the centre of London just today, just asking ordinary Londoners how they're coping, really, with this strange, strange climate.
It's very cold. Yeah, it's the wind what gets you. That's the killer.
Some people are saying this is to do with climate change.
It seems too convenient not to be meshed together in some fashion.
It's freezing.
Have you enjoyed it?
No.
It's been very enjoyable. Yeah. Well, no, it's like Armageddon. It's interesting. Who knows what will happen?
Some people say it's connected with climate change. What do you make of that?
I don't agree with that, sorry. I think it's winter time and it's cold, so...
I'm from Boston in the Northeast in the US, so this is... It's not bad at all.
All right, Leo, we'll hear about the climate change connection in a moment.
Always have to have a Northeast American there just putting us in our place. Oh, I've seen this all before.
You'll be taking on the cold head on tomorrow, just like a good old North American, won't you?
I'm already beginning to regret this. Yeah, but my plan tomorrow is to go and have an open air swim. There's a beautiful open-air swimming pool near where I live. It's heated, kind
yes.
of, minimally. And I've done it once before. It's a cold but amazing experience to be taking a swim, watching snowflakes come down around you.
So, Leo, what is the forecast? Is this cold going to continue?
According to meteorologists, yes. And this isn't the end at all. After the Beast from the East, we've got Storm Emma on its way. Slightly less intimidating name, to be honest. I think they could have done a bit better on that. But I must just tell you, Marco, though, I think although Beast from the East is good, I think the Dutch name for this weather condition is even better.
What's theirs?
It's called the Siberian Bear, which is it's just so much cooler.
We'll leave it there, Leo. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Marco.
That's The World's Leo Hornack there in London. So here's the thing. All that cold air in Europe has to come from somewhere, and where it's coming from is the Arctic. And on the other end of that flow, it's been freakishly warm. It's been the warmest February on record in the Arctic, in fact, including at least one day this week when it was warmer at the North Pole than it was in Paris. Yeah, really. To try to make sense of all this, we're calling up Copenhagen to speak with Ruth Mottram. She's a climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute. Dr. Mottram, how's the weather today in Copenhagen?
It's not too bad right now. It's about -5 now. It was about -10 when I got on my bike to ride to work this morning. So
That's Celsius, isn't it?
Yes, Celsius, sorry. Yes, and it's been quite windy too.
Can you tell us, as briefly as you can, what is going on in general with the weather there in Europe? Why are you getting all this cold and snow?
Yeah, I think I should say that to an extent, the cold is not that unusual. If you look on a long term, it's just the last few years we've had quite some mild winters, and we've sort of forgotten a bit how cold winter can get. So what we are actually seeing is the effect of the polar vortex, which has become quite well known in recent years. And so this is cold air that sort of swirls around in the Arctic, and this has weakened and it's sort of split in two. And so we have one bit that's centered over Baffin Bay, south of Greenland right now, and another part of that is currently fixed over Scandinavia and Eurasia, and that's allowed a lot of the cold air that's in Russia to come over northern Europe and to bring us all this cold and snow.
And I know your work generally focuses on the Arctic and what's been going on there over the last few weeks.
Yeah, so the Arctic has been really very unusually warm, and especially northern Greenland. And this is because as the polar vortex has split in two, it's allowed lots of warm air to move up from the Atlantic. And so it's been nearly 10 days where we've had temperatures above 0 degrees Celsius. And that means that we've actually got open water at the top of Greenland right now, which is incredibly unusual. This is a very, very surprising thing to see.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. What would you say is the relationship between these two trends, unusually cold in Europe and really unusual warm weather in the Arctic?
Well, they're definitely two sides of the same coin. Because the polar vortex is weaker, it's split in two. It's channeled these storms up the east coast of Greenland. There's also at the same time been warm air coming through the Bering Strait. So the Arctic has really been kind of attacked on both sides. And then having this change in the circulation pattern has allowed cold air to come over Europe. I should say that this actually happens reasonably frequently. It's not an uncommon weather pattern. But this has been unusual because it's been much warmer than anything we've ever seen in this record. And it's also been very persistent, as I said.
Yeah. Are you personally alarmed by these two trends happening simultaneously and to such extremes?
Well, it's certainly been a bit surprising. I mean, the last 5 years, 5 or 6 years, we've really seen quite warm winters in the Arctic. So the baseline itself has lifted. But still, when you see it on the graph in front of you, it's really quite a shock.
We've been speaking with scientists for a few years now about the possibility that the warming Arctic is disrupting our weather further south. One or two events, I guess you can't really draw any conclusions, but events like this, as you say, are piling up. Do we have enough data yet to draw bigger conclusions?
It's fair to say that there's a lot of variability in the Arctic. So in that sense, it's very hard to draw conclusions. And this is really still an area of research that's very active at the moment, looking at what is the connection between what's happening in the Arctic and what's happening at the mid-latitudes.
We also know that disappearing sea ice in the Arctic is part of what's contributing to warmer temperatures there as the dark ocean soaks up more heat from the sun. But warming temperatures then led to still less ice. Do you think we're getting locked into this vicious cycle where warming just leads to more warming and our weather gets even more out of whack?
Well, that's certainly an important sort of feedback process in the summertime. Right now, the Arctic is, of course, in complete darkness, so that's not really in play at this point. But there is some research that suggests that because the sea ice is actually at record lows right now, this allows the warm air to get deeper into the Arctic and kind of gives it a boost. But it is really an area of research.
Ruth Mottram at the Danish Meteorological Institute, thanks very much for explaining this.
You're welcome.
In the aftermath of the deadly shooting at that high school in Parkland, Florida, we've seen several big companies, from airlines to banks, taking a stand on the gun debate in this country. Under mounting pressure, several corporations have cut ties with the National Rifle Association. And earlier today, Dick's Sporting Goods, one of the largest sports retailers in the country, announced it would take assault-style rifles off its shelves. Now that pressure is reaching companies outside of the U.S., Canadian outdoor retailer Mountain Equipment Co-op is facing calls to cut ties with Vista Outdoor. Vista Outdoor is a Utah-based company that owns a number of firearms manufacturers, including semi-automatic rifle maker Savage Arms. PJ Miro is one of many members of Mountain Equipment Co-op who is asking the co-op to reconsider its relationship with Vista. PJ spoke with us from Ontario and told us members of the co-op should have a say on the issue.
I'm asking Mountain Equipment Co-op just to let their members vote. If they can't do that, then I'll use my voice another way by spending my money somewhere else.
So let's be clear, because Mountain Equipment Co-op doesn't sell firearms, but it does stock helmets, sunglasses, and other outdoor equipment produced by Vista. I mean, Vista is a parent company to a lot of non-gun gear, right?
And this is one of the incredibly seductive things about our culture. We want beautiful things that make us feel good about that jog, going camping. But we have to acknowledge, we talk a lot in the world about a carbon footprint. But in society where you spend your money and your money makes a vote whether a corporation will sell you, there's a hypocrite footprint too. And we have to vote with our dollars as well as voting at election time.
So even though MEC doesn't sell guns, you see like any purchase from MEC right now, like a bike helmet, as kind of fruit from a tainted tree?
That's exactly right. It is fruit from a tainted tree when you think about the people at the top of the pyramid that these dollars, these small cents that every member of Mountain Equipment buys on something innocent, something that has nothing to do with harming life. And if that money is going to be used to help enrich another company by buying and selling weapons, at the very least, members of a cooperative owe it to their members to ask them what they want.
Well, as you know, MEC has been speaking with its members about this issue the past few days. And according to a statement they released about those conversations, there are members who actually question how much of an impact taking these brands off the shelves and distancing that relationship with Vista will actually have on gun violence. Do you believe this move would have an effect on gun violence? And why do you think that?
I think there's been many incidences in society. Let's stop talking historically. Dick's just stopped selling guns in a public commitment. Dick's is a 100% profit-based, shareholder-controlled organization, and they believe it. That's good enough for me right now.
MEC has also said in one of its statements that some co-op members worry about the financial implications that severing ties with Vista may have on the co-op as a whole. Do you share that concern?
Of course. But there's only one thing that can change what is sold, and that is what is bought.
Do you own a firearm or practice sport shooting?
As a Canadian, it's something that I'm not really indoctrinated in nearly as much as my neighbors down south. I feel safe without a firearm. But we're not even talking about firearms. There's many people that are amazing handlers of weapons, very safe, very conscientious. We're talking about one specific kind of weapon, and it's only designed for one thing, to fire bullets very quickly at a target a far distance away and make that target fall to the ground. That's not about weapons. It's about one class of weapon.
It's interesting. MEC has actually said that many of its members hunt or practice sport shooting responsibly. Have you spoken with any of them, and do they see this differently?
I think that fishermen, I think that hunters, I think that people that like to target shoot have nothing in common or any real loss would they experience if assault rifles went away again in the United States. And if Mountain Equipment Co-op can use those economic ties to help that happen, I think that's all for the good.
Do you have kids?
Three.
When something like Parkland happens, how do you explain it to them? Because they don't see a lot of this in Canada.
Honestly, it's really hard to make kids understand in a real way. And sometimes you have to let them stew on them. You have to show them the real world, and then you have to show them the safety net around them individually so that they have time to grow up and grasp it. And in many ways, that mirrors the way we need to respond as a society. We have to create a safe place to have a longer breathing discussion so we can actually make up our minds without being damned as for or against.
PJ Miro, a member of Mountain Equipment Co-op. He's also the managing director of Patient Critical, a healthcare and advocacy co-op in Canada, speaking with us from Ontario. Thanks very much, PJ.
Thank you.
We reached out to both Mountain Equipment Co-op and to Vista Outdoors to hear their positions, but did not hear back from either in time for broadcast. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. In October last year, 9 soldiers were killed in a convoy leaving the village of Tongo Tongo in Niger in West Africa. 4 of them were American. The deaths were a shock, but almost as shocking for many was the fact that the U.S. troops were on the ground there. Turns out U.S. Special Forces have been in Niger since at least 2013, and it sounds like they'll be there for a while. The U.S. military is building a $110 million drone base in Niger that's set to open later this year. Reporter Joe Penny wrote about it for The Intercept, and I began by asking him what U.S. troops are trying to accomplish in Niger.
They're basically there throughout the country. They're special forces that are charged with training the Nigerian special forces, but then also they're on the ground fighting groups like Boko Haram, like Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and are stationed basically on the borders with Nigeria and Algeria and Mali.
Let me ask you about this drone base, because you visited the city of Agadez where this base is located. What does this remote part of northern Niger look like?
Agadez is really the crossroads between the more southern part of the Sahara and Libya. It's the last major town before you really cross the desert where there's no real cities to speak of. So it's always been this center of trade. And these days it's been a center of migrants trying to go to Libya in order to get to Europe. And it's also the center of different goods that are being trafficked across the Sahara, but also drug trafficking.
Yeah, so this kind of central location in the middle of the desert. I mean, presumably the drones, once they start launching from there, will be looking at all this stuff you mentioned?
Right now, the drones are actually based in Niamey, the capital, and it's in the south of Niger. And they're slated to be moved to Agadez later in 2018. And the drones are going to be looking at drug smugglers on the border with Libya, militant groups along the border with Nigeria. So it's sort of a central location that allows for surveying multiple areas that are of security or other interest to the U.S. and Niger.
And Joe, you found when you were in Agadez that the locals there hadn't really been told why this drone base was there, why U.S. troops were in the area. What are some of the theories that you heard about why they're there?
So because the U.S. and the Nigerian government haven't really had a real communication campaign about the base, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories floating around. I've heard, for example, that the Americans are there to mine gold because it's apparently a rich area. I've heard that they're there to tap the natural water aquifer underneath the Sahara. I've heard that they were the ones who were creating the terrorists and creating these attacks themselves. The conspiracy theories are pretty rife.
Yeah, and has the uncertainty made the Nigerians, especially in the area of Agadez, has it made them more suspicious of the U.S.?
Yeah, I think so. And then a lot of the things that people were telling me was that, for example, they don't really make too much of a distinction between American troops that are there and French troops and also German troops. You know, you have all these Western soldiers that have arrived, but Boko Haram attacks are still happening. The Al-Qaeda attacks are still happening. So there hasn't been a net increase in security since the Western soldiers have arrived. So when you look at it from that perspective, you think, well, what are they actually here for?
Right. How did Niger become this base of operations in West Africa, not just for the U.S., but for France and Germany and Italy?
Well, for one thing, there's a government in Niger that is highly open to Western military presence, which is not necessarily the case elsewhere. For another, it's a democratically elected government, so that helps when justifying the presence. And I think that there's a lot of Western interest, whether that be security or, in Europe's case, also migration, because it's a transit country for hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to get to Europe. And Niger is a country that's open to collaborating on that front.
You spent a lot of time in neighboring Mali, Joe, which had been kind of the main center of extremist activity since 2012 or so in West Africa. Are we seeing essentially the same narrative from Mali today, slipping across the Mali-Niger border of extremist groups that draw inspiration from ISIS and Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been the case even since the war in Mali started in 2012 and then the French invasion in 2013, is that these groups have been sort of operating across the border. But one thing that's been a constant is that there doesn't seem to be a long-term strategy, in my view, for dealing with these groups. The security strategy on behalf of the governments of Mali and Niger and Burkina Faso and Nigeria and Chad have always been a real military-first strategy. The only result from that seems to me to have been deteriorating security. After the Tongo Tongo attack in October that killed four servicemen, you saw that the response to that by the Americans was to ask for authorization to arm the drones that the U.S. will fly out of Agadez. So you have just more and more resources poured into fighting these groups using military means. And then meanwhile, security on the ground continues to deteriorate. There hasn't been real strong case made for the necessity of American troops in Niger, let alone a major drone base. I think that's why you see some sort of growing discontent in Niger for the foreign military presence, because they're not necessarily against foreign military presence. But when you don't see results, positive results, as time goes on, you start to question why things are the way they are.
Reporter Joe Penny there with The Intercept. And one more piece of news to share about this. After Joe's story was published, the U.S. military, aware that their outreach had been inadequate, they opened the drone base to local community and religious leaders, including the governor of Agadez. Okay, with a couple of minutes now before the break, let me share something with you that comes to us via our BBC colleagues in South Africa. It's about a former mixed martial arts champion whose life changed dramatically when he was stricken with meningitis and ended up losing his eyesight. At first, he despaired, but he found a new purpose, working with the blind in South Africa, and he explained his mission to the BBC during a recent shadow boxing workout.
I am Ronald the Black Mamba Dlamini. I'm a mixed martial arts fighter and coach, former South African champion, but now blind.
Just started boxing. Here, here. We're inside the cage.
I've lived life sighted. Now I'm living life blind. So I'm going into life with no limits. Now what I do is to motivate and encourage others to do well in their lives and have their life where they want to have it. What I try to do, I try to help a lot more blind people to stay fit, healthy, and being able to defend themselves in terms of danger when the danger do occur wherever they are. Blind people are often a victim of crime. My hope for the future is able to train a lot more people, encourage, motivate others. Being blind cannot stop you from being successful. So you just need to focus on what you can do. Not on what you cannot do.
Focus on what you can do, not what you can't do. That was Ronald the Black Mamba Dlamini, a former South African mixed martial arts champion. After losing his own sight, he now helps other visually impaired people take up martial arts. I'm Marco Werman. Members of the special effects team for the first Star Wars film had little idea that they were making history.
As soon as we finished the Death Star shots, that was shoveled up, put in the dumpster, and off it went to a landfill.
That's No Moon, a veteran visual effects artist on how technology has changed the movies. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This week, we're bringing you a series called Walls We Don't See, stories about the often invisible barriers people face when trying to enter or stay in the United States. Yesterday, we heard the story of a Canadian child, a three-year-old, whose name matches that of someone on the country's no-fly list, and that makes it very hard for his whole family to travel. On that story, we have an update. The Canadian government has passed a bill that includes funding for a new screening system. Officials say it will help make traveling easier for these kids and their parents. The father of the three-year-old in our story yesterday tweeted, "After being on this journey for more than 2 years, I'm filled with gratitude, pride, and hope today." Now to the second story in our series. To get to the U.S. from Central America by land, you cross a border where there is a wall that you can see. But there are invisible barriers, too, and right there at the top of the list is the rising cost of human smuggling. Reporter Ashley Cleek has more.
Just north of Miami, there's a place called the Guatemalan Maya Center. It helps Central Americans adjust to life in the U.S. Tim Gamwell works there and remembers how, in 2015, as more young Central Americans began arriving, the teenagers started telling these stories about human smuggling fees.
So you start talking to one kid, and then they all want to brag about it almost. You know, they just like all want to tell you, this is what my story was. This is what I owe. This is what I owe.
One teen said his family paid smugglers $10,000.
These kids who are in high school owe tens of thousands of dollars because they came to be with their mom or their dad.
Today, smuggling rates from Central America to the U.S. range between $7,000 to $10,000, double from a decade ago. The reasons why include a more heavily guarded border, the control of Mexican cartels, and demand is steady. Central Americans are still trying to escape poverty and violence. People who study migration, like Stephanie Leutert at the University of Texas at Austin, also point to Donald Trump.
The Trump effect has been largely portrayed as migrants being afraid of Trump. And I think the way that we should be viewing it is that Trump created uncertainty.
Uncertainty that pumped up prices. But families still find ways to pay, surmount these financial walls, to get their kids to the U.S. Zoom in, though, and things get complicated. When you see the risky choices families make to get to the U.S. and how debt can reconfigure their lives. I met Anna and her daughter Julia at the Guatemalan Maya Center. They asked not to use their real names because they're undocumented.
En el 2005, era madre soltera.
Back in 2005, Anna left Honduras. She was a single mom and said she couldn't earn enough to support her kids.
Tuve, digamos, un familiar que me ayudó a prestarme el dinero.
Anna says a relative in the U.S. lent her money, $4,000, to have a smuggler take her across the U.S. border. She agreed to pay her relative back once she got to the States. In Florida, Anna cleaned houses during the day and offices at night.
Porque me encerré a trabajar encerrada.
She says it took 4 months to pay off her debt, working 12 to 15-hour days. Anna says she felt locked away, sleeping in the living room of a family she cleaned for. After paying off her debt, she started sending money back to her kids in Honduras. 12 years passed. Then, last May, Anna's 16-year-old son was robbed at gunpoint. And her oldest daughter, Julia, was mugged.
La única opción protegerlos era traérmelos para acá, que yo sabía que...
Anna decided her kids would only be safe in the U.S. Leutert at UT Austin says parents like Anna have few choices.
They're stuck in kind of with this list of bad options. And they're trying to find the best and the safest option out of a lot of ones that are pretty awful.
Leutert says some parents believe the more they pay, the more likely their kids will get to the U.S., safely.
Por parte de una prima que había venido para acá y prácticamente ellas me dijeron de que era alguien que conocía.
Anna says she contacted the smuggler who helped her cousin cross. They trusted him. Leutert, the academic, says that while there are smugglers who rob migrants and abandon them, many are from the same towns as the migrants, considered trustworthy.
Another thing that gets lost in all this is that migrants are rational actors. They're going to try to protect themselves. They're going to ask around and to try to find a smuggler who they trust.
But then the smuggler in Honduras told Anna his new price.
$8,000 cada uno. $16,000 por los dos.
$8,000 each. $16,000 for Julia and her brother. Anna would have to pay half before they left, half when they got to the border. Anna had $5,000 saved over the years and borrowed the rest, $11,000, from a loan shark who charged 10% interest.
Fue algo demasiado loco, si se puede decir.
Anna says she knows this all sounds crazy. She still works cleaning houses and can only pay back $400 a month. Her daughter Julia says the debt stresses her out.
Si se siente no poder ayudar por los momentos.
Julia, who's 20, is now cleaning houses with her mom. She wants to study business one day, but first the family has to pay off their debt. That could take years. As for the trip north, Julia says it's changed since her mom made the trek. It was a nightmare, she said. At one point, the siblings were stuffed with other migrants into the back of an 18-wheeler.
Uno mantenía la calma, pero ya mirando cómo pasaba el tiempo y que no llegábamos a estar con gente, niños llorando.
Julia says she tried to stay calm, but as the hours passed, she started to panic. They were in the truck for 4 days.
Fueron 4 días de no saber de ellos.
For 4 days, Anna heard nothing from her kids. Then she learned that they were in a stash house on the border, run by the Gulf cartel. Next, they were sent across the river to the U.S. Julia and her brother were picked up by Border Patrol and detained, but eventually released to their mom. Now, they're applying for asylum. Anna, though, is worried she'll be deported, as the Trump administration wants to target parents who smuggle their kids to the U.S. But she says the risks were worth it. She remembers seeing her daughter after years apart.
Princesa! Decirle que es mi princesa y que la amo mucho y que yo sé que no fue un camino fácil, pero...
When she saw her daughter, Anna screamed, "Princess!" and thanked God she was safe. But Anna still has family back in Honduras, two young daughters. Bringing them here, though, means another $16,000 and years more of being in debt. Anna says she'll start saving again as soon as she can. For The World, Ashley Cleek, Lake Worth, Florida.
You all probably know that Vladimir Putin isn't exactly a big fan of independent media. Still, every so often, openings pop up for critical voices in the Russian press.
Putin allowed for the existence of these little oases of free thought and free speech, provided that they don't get too popular.
That's author and screenwriter Michael Idov, who you might have heard on the show earlier this week. He enjoyed one of those little oases of free thought when he became the editor of GQ Russia in 2011 and started rubbing elbows with Russian high society.
The glossy magazines were seen as sort of the elites talking to themselves. And, you know, what harm is there to let the elites kind of vent their frustrations among themselves as long as they don't actually do anything about it? So magazines that were supposed to be just kind of light and breezy were, in fact, the bastions of free speech.
It seems like the Russian establishment kind of embraced you as theirs. Why do you think you, this editor in a tweed suit and faux work boots?
I think they embraced me as a kind of exotic pet because in their eyes, I was not quite American, not quite Russian. I represented New York in many ways. I think what they saw there is just their own aspirations. Russia of 2011, 2012 was really, really obsessed with New York, not Russia, but Moscow specifically. The Moscow kind of elites really fancied themselves kind of these quasi-New Yorkers in a
Why?
Way. So I think that's a great question because I've always been saying that Moscow is more like LA with bad weather than New York because New York is so compact and Moscow, in fact, is so spread out. But somehow there's something about New York that they really see in themselves. And it's hard for me to analyze this, but especially the so-called kind of Brooklyn, you know, hipster culture that actually comes from, you know, Scandinavia by way of Seattle and Portland. But,
right.
You know, it's too complicated for the Muscovites. So they just kind of took it as Brooklyn. I saw a lot of this kind of culture being almost artificially implemented in Moscow, these urbanist comforts, these parks that are purporting to be just like the High Line or something like this. Actually, the more politically oppressive Russia becomes, sort of the more pleasant Moscow becomes as kind of an urbanist paradise, as a place just to live and, you know, have dinner.
So what do you think that tells us about the Russian establishment and what they really admire in the West?
I think the thing to remember about the Russian establishment is that it is aggressively westernized. It's trying to hide it when it's politically not expedient. But you have to remember that the people running Russia are probably the most westernized people in Russia. They are the ones whose children are all in New York and London. They are the ones with villas in the south of France and condos on Central Park West and, you know, apartments in London. And these are the same people who would be devastated if Russia actually closed itself off. So it's a weird double game that they're playing when, you know, they're trying to sort of pretend that the West is the enemy.
So you leave GQ to work in Russian television. Were you looking to get out of journalism and into entertainment?
Yeah, as I grew kind of disillusioned in both my magazine and the protest movement, I started writing TV pilots just to kind of keep my sanity. And suddenly these screenplays were bought and went to series, and I realized that I can't combine that with journalism anymore. So all of a sudden I was a Russian screenwriter, yes.
I suspect you see TV entertainment as a valid voice in providing different opinions on what's happening in a society like Russia.
I do, and I was lucky enough to have two series air on Russian TV, both of which were really unusual for Russian TV fare, because the first one, Leningrad, came out in 2015, just as the West was being declared the enemy again. And this was the first Russian TV show set and shot entirely in the UK, with half the dialogue in English. And, you know, the foreign characters not being villains or comic relief, but freely just mingling with the Russian characters. It was a show that was kind of quietly subversive because it showed fully globalized Russians who live in London without kind of giving a second thought to the idea that they're living outside of Russia.
Лондонград, чтобы помогать таким же русским в Лондоне. Проблемы с местным законом.
The announcer there is telling us that three Russians set up the Leningrad agency to help other Russians in London. Problems with the law, we're on it. Need help with gangsters, no problem. Visa expired, we're a one-stop shop. So, Michael, what made Leningrad so popular, and how did you get it greenlit in Russia? Was that hard?
You can hear from the trailer that it's quite commercial and fun and kind of picaresque, and it takes place in this kind of heightened Ocean's Eleven-style universe of, you know, double and triple crosses. But yeah, when the time came for the show to be on the air, Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine happened between the show being written and the show going on air. So the network tried to sell it as kind of a patriotic show about not the West and the Russians sort of coexisting, but more like the Russians kind of pulling one over the West, or somehow triumphing over the West, something that's absolutely not in the show itself.
I feel there's something else, too, and I just want to read something you wrote in the New York Times 2 years ago. You write, "The only way I was able to make it in the Russian culture was to ignore the facts. Just like I blithely pretended that I was editing GQ, not GQ Russia, I would write my scripts as if they would end up at CBS or Channel 4 in Britain. I didn't force myself to inhabit the Russian point of view, and I think that's precisely what worked." But I got to ask you, why do you think that worked?
I think it's tiring to think of every cultural product as somehow representing your culture. You know, sometimes you just want to feel that you are not special, that your culture is just part of the global pop cultural mainstream. And I think that my shows have provided that feeling to the Russians, that they're not about the achievement of the Russian TV. It's just sort of, it's just TV, you know?
Yeah, just TV, but this is a very, I think it's a very real take on what Russians are living in London. You began by saying that there's this post-truth world that Russia has successfully exported. So is Russia dealing, or at least Russia, as you write it, dealing with reality, and then there's another Russia that deals with a world where nothing matters?
My second TV series, The Optimists, is actually more about that. And that's a much more serious and kind of a less commercial TV series about Soviet diplomats in the 1960s, a fictional department inside the Soviet Ministry of Foreign Affairs that consists of young Russians with experience living abroad.
Дипломат повел на премьеру французского фильма. Любая растает.
Время главных премьер.
Лейся песня над Москвой.
Я, наверное, не вовремя, да?
Выходи за меня замуж.
The repatriates from France and the US and so on. And again, it's a show about people stuck between two worlds, Russia and the West, which is my main topic. But that show was actually about sort of people who consciously try to present kind of an idealized version of the Soviet Union to the West. That's their job. And while they're doing it, they see more and more kind of the true oppressive face of the regime that they're working for, and it begins to break them down. So the show is actually quite bleak, especially compared to Leningrad. Sadly, not seen much around the world, but, you know.
Gotcha.
But I did take one of these offers to do a Russian spy show for American TV. So that's what I'm working on now.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, can't wait to see that. Michael Idov is the author of Dressed Up for a Riot: Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. Thanks very much for being with us, Michael.
Thank you.
Grab the popcorn. Actually, make that two buckets of popcorn. We've got the seemingly endless Academy Awards ceremonies coming up this weekend. You may not know that some of the awards, the ones for science and tech in films, have already been given out. In a minute, you'll hear about one of the winners, a visual effects artist who helped design and throw away the original Death Star from Star Wars. First, though, it's been more than a week since I saw Black Panther, and like many of you, I still can't get parts of that movie out of my head, especially the production design. It really was stunning. And the woman responsible for much of the look and feel of the fictional Wakanda, Hannah Beechler. She's no stranger to Oscar success. Beechler was the driving force behind the look of last year's Best Picture winner, Moonlight. She spoke recently with our BBC colleagues for their show, The Conversation, and they started by asking her about being a woman in a very male-dominated profession.
In this business, your reputation is everything. And I think as females, we sometimes tend to worry about being liked more than we worry about doing the job. And then to be a Black female, it's like, well, there's one, and that would be me. You know, I worked my way up through set deck side, which is set decoration. I didn't come out of film school being a production designer. I came out being a set dresser.
And because of that, Beechler says she felt she had to defeminize herself.
I just stopped wearing makeup. I pulled my hair back. I looked like one of the guys. And in that sense, it was very much a way to protect myself. You know, the biggest problem back then was that you had no recourse. You had no one to talk to. If you complained, you were rocking the boat and you're difficult. And then when I met Ryan Coogler, the director, and started working with him, I realized that I was in a very safe space. So I could suddenly be myself again and not have to think about that, not have to hide myself in a way that I became part of the pack, if you will. And I think now what we're looking at is there is some recourse for some people still below the line. You look at the PA on the set, you look at people who are living paycheck to paycheck who still don't want to rock the boat because they need to feed their kids, pay their bills. So you figure out a way to get through it. Now that people are aware of it, I think that's the first step. We've only scratched the surface.
Hannah Beechler there. She was the production designer most recently for Marvel's Black Panther. I mentioned before that the Oscars for science and tech and film have already been handed out. KCRW reporter Saul Gonzalez has a story of this year's winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award.
There's this old movie you can find online. Shot on grainy film in the 1970s, it shows a group of young men and women working with cameras and miniature spaceships and generally goofing around. They're doing the special effects for a film the world doesn't know anything about yet. A film called Star Wars, and many on the crew think it's going to be a box office dud.
It did look a bit rough and ready. Some of the early dailies that we saw were more than a little shaky.
That's John Erland, who at the time was a young visual effects artist on Star Wars.
And then later, of course, we heard stories of how Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford threatened George Lucas, threatened to tie him up and make him say his own lines.
The British-born Erland came to the U.S. with dreams of becoming an actor. He turned to visual effects because it was just easier to find work, and he had studied industrial design. But Erland says his work in front of the camera prepared him for the tech side of filmmaking.
Acting is a lot more of a science than most people think. It is not all touchy-feely. It is a very deliberate science.
When Erland got the job to work on Star Wars, the special effects crew set up their workshops in a shabby industrial park near a municipal airport in Los Angeles.
And it was also much of it in the height of summer, and we had no air conditioning.
They cooled off with a slip and slide in the parking lot.
Watch it, you've got one on your tail!
But Erland says the crew worked grueling hours, often building new kinds of filmmaking equipment from scratch to create realistic-looking scenes, like the film's climactic space dogfight.
A lot of that was because not only did we have to create all of the stuff that you actually see on the screen, but we had to create all of the equipment and technology that put it on the screen, and all of that was essentially new. So it had to work right out of the gate. As fast as we built it, it had to actually work, and it did.
Well, look at John and all the guys of his era. They figured out how to do all this stuff, and they taught us how to do it, too.
That's Mike Chambers. He's president of the Visual Effects Society, and his recent projects include Dunkirk and the upcoming Wonder Woman 2.
And though the tools and techniques have changed and advanced, it's that basic knowledge and understanding that's set the path for everybody else.
And by the way, they were and are mostly guys. Even today, women make up less than 20% of visual effects artists on big-budget movies. After Star Wars, Erland went on to work on other projects, like the first Star Trek movie, and he developed many filmmaking technologies. But when he looks at movies today, he worries that maybe visual effects have become too important to on-screen storytelling.
There were only 300-odd shots that were effect shots in Star Wars. There are now thousands. Virtually the entire film is a visual effect.
You sound like you're ambivalent about the world you played a role in helping to create, the cinema economy and the cinema world.
Yes, absolutely. Visual effects can do incredibly wonderful things. And if the use of visual effects were constrained to the necessities of effectively telling a story, that would be better than simply the wholesale use of effects for their own sake.
One thing that Erland is happy about is the growing internationalization of the visual effects industry, with places like India and South Korea becoming centers of new production and talent.
America actually, whether it's in film or anything else, needs to realize that creativity doesn't originate here. Creativity is all over the planet. There is no special American lock on innovation and creativity.
All right. Those bags are full of blue screens and green screens. Way in the back, down below, there are buckets of paint.
Now in his 70s, Erland runs a small film equipment rental shop with his wife. He says every so often those who worked on the first Star Wars movie get together to swap stories and catch up. As for the objects they created for the film, objects that would be holy relics to movie fans, well, they're mostly all gone. Take the original Death Star.
As soon as we finished the Death Star shots, that was shoveled up, put in the dumpster, and off it went to a landfill. Today, fragments of that are worth thousands.
So it went to a landfill?
Yeah, we threw away our pensions. The movie business is rife with that. We build things and discard them. As soon as they've been recorded on film, they're thrown away.
For The World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here on The World tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.